still running today. This nuclear plant was turned on in 1969, the absolute heyday of nuclear power in the U.S. Three new nuclear reactors were being turned on every year, each flip of the switch, sending power to 500,000 homes. But it wasn't just the number of reactors being turned on in a year, it was how fast each one was being built. 5 years from breaking ground to turning it on, giving millions of people the benefit from one of the most profound and steady links in the entire field of economics. The more energy a country uses, the better off its people are. And the U.S. just stopped, but it was years before this.
It was an accident at the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant.
The nation and much of the world has been watching as this nuclear nightmare unfolds.
Chaos and confusion reigned as monitors tried to determine exactly how much radiation was released.
It started more than a decade before Chernobyl. So really what happened? Suddenly, plants that announced construction in the 70s started being delayed 9, 12, 20 years. Only four have been built in the U.S. since 1996. This, what really hasn't been well explained before, is exactly what happened.
You pour it out in the hand, and that's radioactive contamination. Very radioactive. That material that I just ate is not soluble in body fluids.
He actually did eat uranium. You can and live to tell about it, apparently. And it wasn't just him. The scientists and researchers at Los Alamos carried mounds of plutonium around in their lab coat pockets during the Manhattan Project.
Here it is, General Groves, plutonium.
The plutonium that went into the first plutonium bomb was driven 220 miles to Los Alamos in a basic army truck. Zero protective anything. These were the brightest scientists in the world. They were not reckless people, and they all died in old age of natural causes. But the message that made its way to the public was much, much different.
The only and true case is that plutonium is the most deadliest substance known to man.
That messaging of fear was the seed of why the U.S. stopped building nuclear power plants. It took root in a very specific way, which I'll explain in detail here in just a second. But that fear ultimately increased the cost to build, the time to build, by 10x in just 5 years between 1973 and 1978. Three Mile Island didn't happen until 1979. That fear, really fear of the unknown, ended up as the main input on a single formula that determines how nuclear plants should be built or if they should be built at all.
Looking at the alternatives for energy, nuclear fission must be stopped.
Why are we playing Russian roulette with the American people for nuclear plants whose principal objective is simply to boil water and produce steam?
And we can all kind of feel that, right? Like you go to the dentist, get an x-ray, they put that heavy vest on you, like, oh, this is kind of serious. Dentist leaves the room, closes the door, click. What bombarded your body in that moment was the same amount of radiation that hits your body every single day. It's everywhere. Radiation is impossible to escape. Hitting you right now, coming from the sun and the ground, and in some places where people spend a lot of time, there's way more of it. It is a long 3-month radiation-soaked journey to climb Mount Everest. Once your flight has touched down in Kathmandu, you've made the 2-week trek to base camp, spend 7 weeks getting used to the altitude, getting to the summit, getting back to Kathmandu, and taking a plane back home, a climber has absorbed 3 years worth of radiation that someone at normal sea level altitude will absorb. The more atmosphere between you and the sun, the less radiation gets through and hits you. For every 5,000 feet above sea level, your radiation exposure doubles. Yet, mountaineers, like those that climb Everest, and the Sherpas or guides that basically live at Everest Base Camp 3 or 4 months of the year, don't have a higher risk of cancer or live shorter lives. People that live in Denver, a mile above sea level, have some of the lowest rates of cancer in the U.S. And that is because the human body has figured out how to live bathed in radiation. You have nerves in your fingers to tell you to stop touching something if it's hot, right? Stop, or that's going to become a problem. But because it's impossible to avoid radiation, your body evolved ways to live with it. Over the course of 10 days, you pick up about 0.2 units of background radiation. At Everest Base Camp, it's 2.5. The 80,000 residents closest to Fukushima after the meltdown, 10 to 50. The workers at Fukushima, 250. What has not been widely reported, because it is kind of a boring headline, there has been no rise in cancer, death, sickness, nothing from Fukushima. Zero. Study after study has shown no effects from the radiation leak.
That there have been no adverse health effects documented.
Still today, only 50 sure deaths have been recorded from Chernobyl. Two-thirds of those came from the firefighters or the operators on site that were often exposed directly to within feet of the reactor core. There has been a significant increase in thyroid cancer from Chernobyl, which sounds scary, but it is a cancer that's easily handled and usually carries no symptoms. The thyroid cancers from Chernobyl have not led to a significant loss of life years. These circles represent all the deaths from different energy sources between 1969 and 2000. Coal, oil, hydro, dams do break occasionally, natural gas, nuclear. Way too big. Nuclear. Wind? Solar. And what really slowed things here in the U.S., Three Mile Island, exactly zero fatalities. No health impact at all. It was benign. It wasn't the actual disasters. It was this. This made law on May 5th, 1975, sent the U.S. nuclear industry to its short, fast death. These are the rules for building, modifying, or extending the life of a nuclear reactor. In 1970, there were 400 industry-accepted standards and four rules for building a nuclear plant. By 1978, there were 1,800 standards and 300 new rules that had to be satisfied if you wanted to flip the switch on. This is the critical phrase in that document, as low as is reasonably achievable, also known as ALARA, which says that every bit of radiation, no matter how small, adds a proportionate bump in your lifetime chance of cancer. And those bumps add up over your whole life. In other words, there's no amount of radiation that's ever considered risk-free, and each exposure stacks on top of the last. So if climbing Everest once gave you a 1% chance of getting cancer, then going up a second time now puts you at 2%, a third time puts you at 3%. This is called the linear no-threshold model. And because of that, a nuclear plant must get radiation output to a level that is as low as is reasonably achievable. If you can lower radiation exposure that might occur to the public, workers, anyone, by any amount, then you must do it. What's interesting about that is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission admitted in 2021 that they're not sure the linear no-threshold model makes sense. It's simply better to be safe than sorry. So if you enshrine that as the guiding principle in the rulebook for building nuclear power plants, anyone was able to challenge the design or plans of a project. This could be a little better, or, and this is a real example, what happens if a 2-foot section of that pipe disappeared? Engineers were like, what? Sections of pipe don't just disappear. We can't model that. If there is no level of radiation that is safe, as low as reasonably achievable is wide open to interpretation. That is exactly what happened, and there's an immense amount of clean data that shows it. Challenges and rules ramped up, and that is exactly why the time to build a plant absolutely skyrocketed, taking cost to build along with it, because time, in this case, really did, and in a big way, equal money. Build a plant, hook it up to the grid, deliver electricity to customers. The amount of money a power plant is going to make over its lifetime is very predictable. But get the building timeline or cost wrong, and the predictability goes out the window because the entire project has to be financed before it makes a single dollar. Loans are taken out upfront, and interest has to be paid on that money from the moment it's received, all through construction, not just once the plant starts running. So the longer the plant isn't running, the more interest it has to pay. The more interest it has to pay, the less attractive it is to build one. But what does it actually cost a major nuclear project to be delayed, let's say, 1 month? The U.S. Congressional Budget Office says $44 million. There are countless stories of construction crews finishing a part of a plant only to have to completely rip it out a few weeks later and rebuild the same thing, just in a slightly different way after a new rule came in. About one rule or standard was being created every day between 1973 and 1978. Think about that. You designed and planned your reactor in 1971. By 1978, all these new requirements had to be satisfied. These plants all began construction between 1972 and 1975. Shoreham in New York, 12-year delay, canceled. Midland in Michigan, 13-year delay, canceled. Sequoia in Tennessee, 8-year delay. Comanche Peak in Texas, 10 years. Seabrook in New Hampshire, 14 years. The utility went bankrupt, the first utility bankruptcy since the Great Depression.
We're here to review the licensing and whether the Seabrook plant received its full power license on March 1st after 17 years of delay. And those delays in Seabrook have been staggering.
If you're an investor or utility and you watch this happen to everyone building a nuclear reactor, would you try to build one? You would not. $44 million per month is too much. But then add in $20 million in lost revenue from not operating for that month, and every month of delay adds about 3 months of operating the plant at full capacity flawlessly to get back that 1 month of delay.
The capital cost of building a nuclear power has increased tenfold over the last decade.
That financial math stopped working, a large part of it due to the increase in materials needed. The amount of concrete, steel, and cable required to get a license doubled, but the number of man hours required to build a plant went up 600%, all during the exact time when interest rates in the U.S. were exploding. An investor in 1980 could buy government bonds and get 12% interest. Why give a ton of money to a nuclear project when the outcome was becoming unpredictable and you could just buy bonds instead? Nuclear died over the course of about 10 years, and it could not come back. By the time interest rates came back down in the 90s, suppliers, experts, engineers retired or out of business. Building a new plant or reactor was almost a grassroots movement again. Now, to be fair, perhaps all of these rules did, in fact, lead to safer nuclear plants. Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, Fukushima, they all caught major headlines. But the loss of life over all situations that have ever developed at any nuclear reactor is very small. It's important to acknowledge that, and frankly, there's no way to disprove it. But it has come with a major trade-off that affects billions of people. Because this thing could power the entire city of San Francisco. It's the most recent reactor built in the U.S., turned on in 2023. It is the fourth of four reactors on a site about the size of four Central Parks. Together, those four reactors could power all of Manhattan, Brooklyn, and Queens. Everything, homes, factories, office buildings, with a little room to spare. This density, this tiny land footprint, the complete lack of emissions, it's as clean as solar and wind. The stuff that comes out of the top is just water vapor. This is what makes nuclear so attractive to so many people, especially when we look at the alternatives. Assuming very sunny skies, solar would require at least 25 times the land. Assuming solid wind, wind turbines would require 300 times the amount of land. Natural gas would actually take up less land, a lot less. Coal, about half. They require big coal yards to feed the furnace. Right here, we're gonna leave coal and natural gas behind. Amazing, stable, and absolutely critical sources of electricity. In fact, the first video I ever put out on this channel was about natural gas. But what comes out of them in addition to electricity is not what most people would prefer. Even if the sun shined perfectly, all day, every day, in a place near enough to New York that a solar farm could deliver electricity over a reasonable distance of transmission lines, the sun goes down at night, which means a big chunk of the energy the solar panels collected would need to be stored in batteries. Many of them, increasing the land footprint of the solar option by at least 5%, which is enough space to build four more nuclear reactors. And what is often not mentioned with solar is that whatever in the 150 square miles that was soaking up the sun, the solar panels are now soaking up, is going to find life to be much different, maybe impossible. All of this is the same for wind. It doesn't blow all the time, or it might blow at the wrong time, located too far away from the place that needs to use it. But the footprint of each windmill is pretty small, so the actual land that's underneath can, in theory, be used for other things like grazing cattle. This is the kind of thing they do in Texas, which has by far the most windmills of any U.S. state. Texas, the oil state, believe that. But with wildlife, what is rarely talked about with windmills, two groups of animals love to fly in the air column dominated by the blades of a windmill, about 100 to 250 feet in the air where wind is most consistent. Wind is a transportation system for bugs and birds, and wind farms are strategically placed right in the middle of the highway. Blades become caked with bugs. Whole companies have sprouted up just to provide the service of blade cleaning to wind farms because the amount of bugs they cake up can lower the efficiency of a windmill by 20 to 25%. Bugs are a critical part of the food chain. Everything else relies on them. And the birds?
These turbines in Northern California kill on average 80 golden eagles a year. In the South, this project kills fewer birds, but at a higher rate.
It's the big protected birds. Eagles, hawks, not like your little sparrow kind of neighborhood birds, that litter the base areas of windmills, which are all made of concrete. Each one sitting on a 12-foot deep, 50-foot wide slab. Cabling, fiberglass, aluminum, transportation, everything that goes into building a wind farm puts them at least on par with all the materials required to build a nuclear plant. And each windmill has a lifespan of only 20 to 25 years compared to a nuclear plant which runs for 80 years, maybe more. We can go on and on looking at the different trade-offs between all these ways to generate electricity. They do exist both ways. It's important to acknowledge. But when you really back out the safety aspect, the decades of data on radiation, the low land requirement, how reliable the electricity from nuclear is, it's challenging to come up with a great reason to build something else instead of nuclear plants. The one that usually bookends this discussion is nuclear waste. What to do with it? What if someone steals it? No one is going to steal these heavy concrete blocks that encase the spent nuclear fuel. Stored above ground, you can walk up and touch them. Even if they did manage to lug one off unnoticed, they'd have to figure out a way to make the fuel inside 20 times more potent. Something Iran's military has been trying very hard and unsuccessfully to do for decades. Each nuclear reactor creates about one per year. That's the cost to give a million homes emission-free electricity. And there are compelling answers to all of those questions that piggyback off the radiation bit we talked about earlier. Ultimately, again, it boils down to the fear. We can all feel it. Maybe it was the Simpsons' fault.
Yeah, well, it's always been like that.
Maybe it was the use and testing of atomic weapons and the imagery around all of that. Maybe it was the nuclear industry's fault, insisting that nuclear is fail-safe, nothing would ever go wrong, and then things went wrong at a bunch of nuclear plants. What else are you lying about? Perhaps smaller is the key, because when a nuclear submarine smashes up through Arctic ice, the nuclear reactor that powers it is fine. In service for over 70 years, there has never been a problem, let alone a meltdown on a nuclear-powered submarine or aircraft carrier. And we're not just talking a handful of these things. More than 200, traveling millions of miles around the globe, all fitted with a nuclear reactor that produces about 8% of the power the newest reactor in the U.S. we looked at earlier does. Going up and down in the ocean, fast, slow, vertical, horizontal, these are a critical part of the nuclear defense system. They have to work. This, basically a nuclear submarine engine, is what they're talking about if you've heard the term small modular reactor, or SMR. Putting a submarine reactor on land and doing it exactly the way the Navy does it, which is where the modular comes from in modular reactor. Build the whole thing, all the pieces in a factory, and then ship them to where they need to be installed. As opposed to today, where a nuclear reactor is bespoke and almost entirely built on site. This cookie cutter approach, every reactor is the same, keeps costs down. If something breaks on one, you know right where to look on all the others. This is what GE says the one they're building in Ontario, Canada will look like. At about 5%, the physical size of a normal nuclear plant, power-hungry data centers feeding AI are clamoring for these and would love to have their own SMR. That's one of the reasons nuclear has become a hot topic again. We might be near it. The CEO of GE says there's now, due to a big shakeup at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, a very real chance these become a meaningful addition to the grid starting in 2030. Maybe, just maybe, the small size is what shakes the U.S. out of its nuclear days. Because this, a giant, ominous nuclear plant that everyone has learned to associate with the green goop from The Simpsons, might just be too big of a mental hurdle for us to get past. We'll see. My instincts say the U.S. is turning the corner on nuclear, but you never know until it's done. Fear is an extremely powerful motivator.
Seabrook's opponents, who profess concern over the environment, continue their crusade against a clean, safe power plant that will reduce our air pollution problems and increase our supply of domestically produced energy. This plant has already been through some 17 years of intense scrutiny. It has passed every test, every hurdle, every obstacle thrown in its path. And these obstacles have been costly.